You know, I was looking at some automotive data yesterday, and it just completely wrecked a narrative I've had in my head for
Oh,
years.
yeah. Which one?
It's funny how you just assume technology always moves in one direction, right?
Oh, absolutely. We tend to think, smaller, faster, and definitely lighter,
Yeah,
like our phones.
exactly. I look at my smartphone, then I look at my laptop, and everything is getting sleeker. So naturally, I just assumed the same was true for cars.
Especially with all the pressure to cut emissions.
Right, and save fuel. But then I looked at the actual numbers, and the data says the exact opposite.
It does. You've stumbled upon what they call the weight paradox.
It is genuinely confusing. If you look at the last 30 years, I mean, basically since the early 90s, cars in the US have consistently gotten heavier.
And not by a little bit.
No, not just a few pounds. We are talking significant mass added year over year.
Which seems completely counterintuitive. We have stricter fuel economy standards than ever before. Logic dictates we should be driving feathers by now to save gas.
So why are we driving bricks?
Because we are demanding consumers. It's a battle of conflicting desires.
How so?
We want the fuel efficiency, sure, that's the green part. But we also demand five-star safety ratings. We want reinforced cages, crumple zones, side impact beams, six different airbags.
And we can't forget the comfort. We want the cabin to be silent, which means heavy soundproofing. We want heated seats with motors, sunroofs, 12-speaker sound systems.
Exactly. All of that adds mass. So we're stuck in this loop. The government says burn less gas, which needs less weight.
And the consumer says, keep me safe and comfortable, which needs more weight.
And that tension creates a massive engineering headache. How do you strip weight out of the car without stripping out the safety?
That is the multi-billion dollar question.
And that brings us to today's deep dive. We're looking at a PhD thesis by Shyam Maklanka from the University of Cambridge.
Okay.
And I have to say, usually metallurgy papers are. Well, let's be honest, they can be a bit dry.
I was expecting a textbook, but this reads like a suspense novel where the protagonist is a piece of metal trying to survive a car crash.
It really does. The mission here is to create a material that sort of breaks the fundamental rules. The industry needs a steel that is so incredibly strong that you can use very thin sheets of
To cut the weight.
it, drastically cutting the weight, but it won't snap when you crash.
The thesis throws around this holy grail number, 30 GPA per cent.
That's the magic number. It's the metric that keeps material scientists awake at night.
Let's unpack that because it sounds like pure jargon. What does 30 GPA per cent actually represent in the real world?
So it represents the product of two opposing forces, ultimate tensile strength and total elongation. To hit that target, you need a steel with a tensile strength over 1,000 megapascals.
Which is a lot.
It's enormous. Standard mild steel, the stuff a lot of older things are made of, might be around 250, maybe 300 megapascals.
Wow.
So we're talking 3 to 4 times stronger. But here's the catch. You also need it to stretch. You need about 30% elongation.
And that's the paradox, because in the material world, usually you have to pick a lane.
Right. Think of glass. It's incredibly strong, very hard. You can stack a lot of weight on a block of glass. But if you try to bend it, even a fraction of a percent,
It shatters.
zero ductility.
Yeah.
It's gone.
And conversely, you think of like chewing gum. You can stretch it across the room, infinite ductility, but it can't hold any weight. It's weak.
Exactly. And usually, as you process steel to make it stronger by adding carbon or heat treating it, it moves towards the glass end of the spectrum. It gets brittle.
I see.
And as you make it softer and stretchier, it loses strength. Lenka's thesis is trying to get the strength of glass and the stretch of gum in a single mass-producible alloy.
And to do that, he turns to something called trip steel. Now, I've heard this acronym before, but I've never really understood the mechanism. It's transformation-induced plasticity. It
Cryo.
sounds like a sci-fi ability. Transformation-induced. It implies the steel literally changes its identity.
That is literally what happens. It's a shape-shifting material. This isn't just a static block of iron. It's a complex microstructure, a cocktail, really. You have a base of bonetic ferrite, which provides that foundational strength. But the secret weapon is something called retained austenite.
Austenite is usually a high temperature phase, right? Like
Yeah.
you only see it when the steel is glowing red hot in a forge.
Usually, yes. It has what's called a face-centered cubic crystal structure. It's relatively soft and very formable. And normally, as steel cools down, that austenite naturally transforms into other harder things. It doesn't want to exist at room temperature.
So the trick here is to retain it. to trap this high-temp ghost inside the cold steel.
Exactly. You chemically stabilize it so it stays as austenite at room temperature. It just sits there, dormant inside the steel matrix, waiting.
Waiting for what? For me to crash my car into a tree.
Precisely. When that steel undergoes mechanical stress, like the bumper crumpling, that energy triggers the austenite. It suddenly snaps into a different crystal structure called martensite.
And martensite is the hard stuff.
The hardest. It's body-centered cubic, extremely rigid. So just imagine the physics here. As your car is crushing, the steel is literally hardening itself in real time to fight the crash.
Oh.
It absorbs the energy of the impact to fuel this transformation.
That is fascinating. It's an adaptive material. Instead of just breaking, it uses the energy that would break it to become stronger.
Yes.
It's like a video game character that powers up when it takes damage.
That is a surprisingly accurate analogy. And this transformation does something very specific. It delays necking.
Necking.
Yeah, think about pulling a piece of taffy. Before it snaps, it gets really thin in the middle, right?
Right.
That's necking. It's the onset of plastic instability. This transformation from austenite to martensite hardens the material locally, preventing that thin spot from forming too early.
Ah, so it reinforces the weakest point as it forms.
It does, and that gives you that extra stretch, that ductility, without sacrificing the ultimate load it can carry.
So, on paper, this sounds solved. We have the mechanism, we have the dream material. Why aren't we building the entire car out of this tomorrow?
Because you can't just have a block of super steel. You have to build a car out of it. And this is where the thesis runs into a massive wall.
The welding wall?
The welding wall. A car isn't one solid piece.
It's thousands of sheets of metal stuck together.
Thousands of them. And the auto industry relies almost exclusively on spot welding. You clamp two sheets, you zap them with a high current, melt a tiny spot, and move on. It's fast, cheap, and robots do it perfectly.
But this TRIP steel, it doesn't like the zap.
It hates it. And this brings us back to the chemistry. To get that 1,000 MPa strength we talked about, the easiest lever to pull is carbon.
Right. Want strong steel, just dump more carbon in.
But the thesis highlights a very specific threshold, 0.25 weight percent.
Okay, what happens if you go over that?
If you go over that limit, welding becomes a nightmare. Remember, spot welding melts the metal, and then it cools incredibly fast. It's basically a rapid quench.
And if you quench high-carbon steel.
You get untempered martensite. But not the good transformation-induced kind we just talked about that forms slowly during a crash.
Yeah.
This is brittle, nasty stuff. And it forms right in the heat-affected zone around the weld.
So you build your high-tech, super-strong car, drive it off the lot.
And the first bump you hit, the welds could just pop. The sheets would literally separate because the area around the weld has turned to glass.
So Lenka is in a massive bind here. He needs high strength, which usually demands high carbon, but he needs to weld it, which bans high carbon.
Exactly.
It feels like he's trying to bake a cake that's sweet but forbidden from using sugar.
That's a great analogy.
Yep.
So he has to look for alternative ingredients. He has to get creative with the recipe. And the thesis focuses heavily on a specific mix, particularly the role of silicon.
So I usually associate that with computer chips or maybe bathroom sealants, not snail bumbers. What's it doing in the mix?
It's playing defense. There's a compound called cementite iron carbide.
Okay.
In this specific type of steel, cementite is the villain. It's brittle, it's useless for our purposes, and worst of all, it consumes the carbon.
The carbon that we need to save for the austenite.
Exactly. Remember, we need that carbon to stabilize the austenite so we can do its magic trick later. If cementite eats the carbon, the austenite becomes unstable and just vanishes.
So where does silicon come in?
Silicon is insoluble in cementite. It physically cannot exist inside that crystal structure. So you add enough silicon or aluminum, which acts similarly, you effectively ban cementite from forming.
So it's like a chemical bouncer.
It is. It
Yeah.
tells the carbon, you can't go into the cementite club, the door is locked.
Right, so the carbon has nowhere else to go.
It's forced to partition to move into the austenite instead. And that enriches the austenite with carbon, making it stable enough to survive at room temperature.
But it's not just about dumping silicon in, is it? The thesis talks about the T0 concept.
Yeah, the T0 curve. This is where it gets into deep thermodynamics.
They look like a thermodynamic speed limit.
That's essentially what it is. The T-Leplec curve defines the limit of the reaction. It dictates how much bainite can form before the carbon levels in the remaining austenite get too high for the reaction to continue.
So you have to walk a tightrope.
A very fine one. You need enough bainite transformation to get your base strength, But you need to stop the process just in time to leave enough stable austenite for ductility.
It sounds like cooking the perfect steak. Pull it off the grill too early, it's raw. Too late, it's leather.
But imagine the window for error is milliseconds, and you're controlling it with atomic diffusion rates.
Easy.
Right, just a walk in the park.
Yeah.
And to make matters worse, theory doesn't always translate to reality. There was a section in the thesis about microstructural banding that I found really telling.
Oh, I marked that section too. This was the part where they tried to make the grains smaller, right? Because standard and material science says smaller grains equal better performance.
The Hall pitch relation. It's one of the first things you learn in Material Science 101. Finer grains usually mean higher strength and toughness. So Lenka tried lowering the austenitization temperature.
Heating it up less.
Right. Heating the steel up less before cooling it to keep those initial grains from growing too big.
And logic says the steel should have gotten better, but the data showed it got worse.
Much worse. It failed prematurely.
Why? What went wrong?
Because by not heating it up enough, the alloying elements, specifically things like manganese, didn't diffuse evenly. They clumped up.
Oh.
When the steel cooled, it separated into layers. You had bands of hard martensite and bands of softer ferrite just stacked on top of each other.
Like a lasagna.
Exactly like a lasagna.
Yeah.
And while lasagna is delicious, it is terrible for structural integrity.
Because the layers just slide past each other.
Well, the problem is heterogeneity. When you pull on that layered structure, the stress isn't shared evenly. The hard layers fight the soft layers. Huge stress concentrations build up at the interfaces and cracks form. The whole thing just unzips.
So it was a failure.
But a valuable one. It proved that chasing one perfect parameter, like grain size, can actually ruin the macrostructure if you aren't careful about homogenization.
Speaking of failure, there was a theoretical model in here that really blew my mind, percolation theory.
I love this section. It brings such a different perspective.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't percolation theory usually used for fluids, like calculating if water will seep through coffee grounds?
Or if a forest fire will spread from tree to tree. It's about connectivity.
That's what.
It's the mathematics of networks.
So how do you apply fluid dynamics math or force fire math to a solid chunk of steel?
You treat the austenite, that soft transformable stuff, as the network. Lenka posits that for the steel to stretch, this soft phase needs to form a continuous path through the material.
Like a chain link fence embedded in the metal.
Exactly. A continuous path that allows the deformation to travel. Now, as you stretch the steel, remember what happens. The austenite transforms into martensite.
It turns into hard rock.
So your soft network starts disappearing. Links in the chain are turning to stone.
Okay.
Lenka's model suggests there is a percolation threshold, specifically around 0.1 or 10%.
So if the amount of connected austenite drops below 10%.
The network is broken. The path for stress redistribution is gone. The material can no longer accommodate the deformation, and it snaps.
That is such a cool mental image. We tend to think of steel as this static, solid block. But he's modeling it as a dynamic, shifting network of probabilities. The failure isn't just mechanical, it's mathematical.
It connects the probability of finding a path to the physical tearing of a car bumper. It predicts exactly when the ductility will run out based on how the network degrades.
So we have the silicon recipe to manage the carbon. We avoided the banding trap. We understand the percolation threshold. The big question is, did he actually pull it off? Did he hit 30 GPI percent?
He did. The thesis details two specific formulations, creatively named Alloy A and Alloy B.
Classic scientist naming convention. No titanium X or anything cool.
Don't fix what isn't broken. But yes, both alloys broke the barrier. They achieved the super high strength over 1,000 MPa and the elongation around 30%.
But what about the welding?
The welding wall.
Yeah.
Even if the alloy is perfect, if the welds snap, you can't build a Ford out of it.
Right.
Exactly. The low carbon concept helped, but the welds were still a weak point relative to the rest of the material, so they implemented a post-processing fix. Two of them, actually.
One was tempering, right?
Yes. Baking the entire steel structure at a lower temperature for a few hours. It acts as a stress relief. It just softens that brittle martensite enough to stop the cracking without losing the overall tensile strength.
And the other was specifically for the robots, pulse tempering.
This is really clever. Usually welding robot goes zap and moves on. Post-tempering changes the program to zap, wait, zap. It applies a second, lower energy pulse of heat right after the weld forms.
So it tempers the weld spot in real time on the assembly line.
Exactly. It toughens the nugget immediately before the car even moves to the next station. This makes the material not just a lab curiosity, but something they could actually run on a production line without slowing things down.
That is the key difference between science and engineering, isn't it? Making it work on a timer.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap up, I want to give you a minute to geek out. There was a section at the very end of the thesis about the habit plane. You flag this as important, even though it sounds incredibly obscure.
It is obscure, but it's the cherry on top for metallurgists. The habit plane is the specific geometric plane where the new crystal structure forms inside the old one.
The interface.
It's the interface between the parent austenite and the new bainite. And Lenka measured this with extreme precision. He found the habit plane of the bainite plates was close to gamma.
4 or 5, 7, that's oddly specific. It's not a nice round number.
It's an irrational index. But that's why it matters. That specific irrational number isn't random. It aligns perfectly with the phenomenological theory of martensite crystallography.
Which is a mouthful.
It is. But it means the discovery isn't a fluke. The fact that the physical measurement matched this complex theoretical prediction validates the entire model. It proves that these bainite plates are forming exactly how the fundamental laws of physics say they should.
So it anchors the discovery in established science.
It anchors this new industrial steel to basic atomic theory. It's the proof in the pudding.
Or the proof in the lattice, I guess.
Exactly. It gives you confidence that you actually understand what is happening down to the atomic level, which is crucial if you're going to trust your life to this material at 70 miles per hour.
So let's zoom out and recap. We started with the weight paradox. We dove into a microscopic world of shape-shifting crystals, fought off the villain cementite with silicon bouncers, learned why lasagna structures are bad for bumpers, and used probability math to predict failure.
And the result is a material that solves the paradox. It allows us to make cars lighter, saving fuel and reducing emissions without giving up the complex safety cages that keep us alive.
It really changes how you look at a car door, doesn't it? It's not just a stamped sheet of metal. It's a frozen chemical reaction waiting to save your life.
It is a highly engineered dynamic system. It's smart steel.
I want to leave our listeners with a thought that stuck with me from the percolation section. We talked about how the steel fails when the network disconnects.
Right, the connectivity of the soft days.
We usually think of solids as absolute, reliable, unchanging. But this thesis modeled the strength of steel as a network maintaining a probability threshold. It implies that solidity is really just a matter of connection.
That's true. If the connections break, the solid fails.
Exactly. It worked for fluids, it works for computer networks, and it works for solid metal. So here's the question. If we can model a solid block of steel as a shifting network of probabilities, what other solid things in our world, our institutions, our economies, maybe even our relationships, are actually just networks waiting to reach their breaking threshold?
That is a heavy thought to end on, but a fascinating one. It makes you want to check the connectivity of everything around you.
Something to mull over while you rely on that steel to keep you safe in traffic. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
We'll catch you on the next one.